VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
Last year was the third worst year in history. So about 4% of the state burned last year. However, 11,466 structures burned out of 14 million structures in California. So that's less than 0.1%. So while it feels like the whole state is burning, at the same time, the actual chances of a fire burning down your house are, in the third worst year in history, you know, less than 0.1%.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. I'm your host, Danny Fortson. Thank you for tuning in this week. Get ready, people. We're talking about insurance. Please, I hope you didn't just pass out from boredom like I just did. No, I joke. I assure you, this is not your daddy's insurance we're talking about. Because what we'll actually really be talking about is climate change and what it is doing to the insurance industry. So the number of mega disasters has tripled in the last 15 years just in the US alone. And that has just completely upended one of the world's largest and oldest industries. And not surprisingly, perhaps, there's a whole bunch of young Turks who have been watching for this play out and have decided to jump in to really try to shake things up. And among them is Nat Manning, who is this week's guest. Now, Manning is the co-founder of a company called Kettle. They're based out here. It's just over a year old. They've raised just short of $30 million. And what they're doing is basically turning machine learning algorithms loose, looking particularly at wildfire risk and how to come up with a better way to assess it, to price it, and to offer it as reinsurance. And reinsurance, if you don't know, is quite crucial. It's basically the insurance companies for the insurance companies. They make sure when things go really wrong that you get paid. But why should we care about what is happening more broadly in the insurance industry? If you think about it, insurance is kind of like the lubricant of modern society. It's this backstop that kicks in when things go really wrong, help people get back up on their feet. When it stops working, it's a huge problem. And that's kind of what is unfolding as we speak in California due to these rampant wildfires, these once in a generation catastrophes that now happen every year. So if you think about just your home, if you can't get insurance, you can't get a loan. No bank will give you money. They can give you a mortgage. If you can't get a loan, you can't buy a house. Or if you're in a house and that is suddenly deemed uninsurable because it's in a high fire zone, you're in no man's land. You have a house no one will buy, so you can't sell it. You can't move. You're just stuck there hoping it doesn't burn down, leaving you with nothing. But really, the broader point here, again, is that climate change is really rendering a lot of the historical models that have underlying this industry for centuries. They don't work anymore in a world where you have floods and hurricanes and fires and hailstorms and all these kind of freak events that were once freak but are now much more common. And so it's really forcing a reimagining of how this all works. And there's big, big money at stake here. So that is what I wanted to talk to Nat about, because he provides just a glimpse of how this machinery behind the scenes is kind of breaking down as the world warms up. And there's a lot of kind of fallout from that, as we see here in California, where insurance companies are trying to pull out, regulators forcing them to stay, premiums are shooting through the roof, people can't afford to live in their homes because they can't afford to pay their insurance. So you have all of this kind of violent upheaval happening in the industry, and then you have a bunch of upstarts, Kettle among them, who are kind of trying to jump in and turn machine learning algorithms, kind of the latest and greatest technology, to try to come up with a better mousetrap. So that is what we talk about. So like I said, insurance! And just one thing before we get to Nat, just in terms of the timing, we talked about 10 days ago, so we're talking about some things like this big fire in California that were just unfolding that are now kind of subsided, a bit more under control. But just to give you a sense of the timing, it was about 10 days ago, so just bear that in mind as you hear some of the kind of references about the here and now. Enjoy! I wanted to have you on because the world is falling apart, and I figured you'd be a good person to talk to about this. And what I mean by that is, I think when we spoke not too long ago, I mentioned I had just been in South Lake Tahoe, and I was looking, this Calder fire, which is now just raging toward the lake and has already destroyed 500 homes, burnt 200,000 acres. It started the day we were leaving, the 14th of August. And it's just, this fire is really interesting. And I think apropos of what I want to talk to you about, because they're like, you have these Sierra Nevada mountains, they're super high elevation, there's lots of granite, and the theory was a wildfire wasn't supposed to be able to get that high and then jump over granite mountains to burn stuff up. But that is happening, and it's happening there, as well as another fire in California right now. So it's kind of this once-in-a-generation, theoretically, catastrophe that is happening right now, which followed a once-in-generation catastrophe that happened last year during fire season. And on it goes and on it goes. So I was wondering, so could you just describe what that does to the insurance industry or insurance companies who have, the cascade of effects? And I think that would be a good way to get into what it is that you guys are doing and why it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. So also here in California, and it's been a scary few years. And what these new mega fires are doing are causing these ripple effects through the whole insurance industry. Because what is insurance? It's this system where we all pool our money together to essentially, I find this very beautiful, elegant system, where we all pool our money together to essentially take care of those when a crisis happens, catastrophe happens. And what's happening, right, with climate change is we're just seeing more and more of these. We've seen a 3x increase in billion-dollar catastrophes over the last 15 years in the U.S. alone.
So a tripling of billion-dollar catastrophes.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's hurricanes, wildfires, flooding, all the stuff. All the biblical stuff.
All the biblical stuff, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, not including COVID. So just these climate-related disasters. And what that means is that there's a lot more money that has to be paid out, right? Which, to insurance, right? Insurance is trying to make sure that it collects enough premiums and understands the risk across a wide swath of area to be able to have enough money to be able to make people whole for those who get hurt, right? And it's called actuarial modeling. But what the historical models do is they look at the past 500 years and say, hey, if this spot in Tahoe has burned down three times or two times, let's say, in the last 500 years, then there's a 1 in 250 chance it's going to burn down.
Right.
The problem with that is that, you know, the data from the last 500 years is no longer really predicting what's going to happen in the next 15 years. We have changed things so much that the models aren't working in the same way. And traditionally, what has been used is a stochastic modeling approach. So looking at the data and then understanding what's going to happen, like that 1 in 250 I mentioned. But this is a problem, right? Because what happens, right, when you don't have these safety nets to be able to make people whole, right, is what's the downstream effect of this? It can get quite nerve-wracking, right? If in California housing, if suddenly you don't have the reinsurance there to insure the insurance companies, and the insurance companies start dropping houses and saying, this doesn't make financial sense for us anymore to insure. Well, if you can't get home insurance, you can't get a mortgage.
Yeah.
Now, if tons of areas aren't able to get mortgages, you've got a housing crisis, right? The demand for homes drops through, and we all remember what a housing crisis feels like. So,
or you just have a bunch of stranded assets, right?
Exactly.
Where people are like, okay, if I want to move out of this high fire zone, I simply can't because no one will buy my house, because no one will lend against it, because no one will insure it.
Yep. Yeah. That's the worst case scenario sort of
right.
structure. Yeah. So for sure it is, you know, I've been here the last 11 years and things have changed a lot during that time, right? Like the last 5 years, we've been just dealing with smoke, and particularly over the last three, it just feels like every year it gets a month longer, right? However, if you look at the actual structures burned, the actual fires, what damage that's causing, last year was the third worst year in history. And it was actually the worst year in history from total acres burned. So about 4% of the state burned last year. It was roughly 100 million acres, about 4 million acres burned last year. However,
right.
11,466 structures burned out of 14 million right. structures in California. So that's less than 0.1%. So while it feels like the whole state is burning and smoke damage is bad, it's causing problems for agriculture, it's causing problems for working outdoors, this is all true. Yeah. At the same time, the actual chances of a fire burning down your house are, in the third worst year in history, you know, less than 0.1%.
Right, right. And so what are you doing, right? Because you talk about, you know, the insurance industry, it's this kind of, you know, people's eyes glaze over at the very mention of the word insurance.
Yeah.
But it is one of these kind of bits of quite important plumbing that kind of makes the world go round, at least in the West. What are you guys doing that is different? Or how are you approaching this? Because surely these gigantic insurance companies and the reinsurance companies, which of course are the ones that then take on the risk from like a Geico or a State Farm or whomever, their job is to assess risk. Surely they're like seeing the same things you are, of just like, these old models seem less relevant. We've got to figure out a different way to go about this.
Yeah. So the eyes glaze over when anyone mentions insurance or reinsurance, like something I'm very used to. And I gotta say, it feels like sort of our superpower. The fact that, honestly, I don't know what's wrong with me. My parents are actually artists, and they apparently, when I was a kid, they said, you know, he can grow up to do whatever he wants as long as he doesn't become an insurance salesman. True story. And actually, when they told me that, it, like, you know, it caused me to wait a few years to kind of go start this company, which, in the classic sort of why now,
because they had planted that seed.
Planted that,
just,
I felt like
I was like,
I can't do this to my mother. What we do at Kettle is use advanced AI machine learning to do a much better job of understanding risk.
Yeah.
Our first product is on wildfire in California. And what we actually do is we focus on the reinsurance part of insurance. And so I'll take a second to just explain what reinsurance is, because most people might not know. And so what's happening in the insurance chain, you might own a home here in California, let's say, and you go get insurance from Allfarm, we'll call them. Mm-hmm. And what Allfarm set up to do is take care of the many thousands of things that could go wrong with your home. Say your roof leaks, or you get robbed, et cetera, et cetera. Or you get burned down in a giant wildfire. Well, when that happens, they're actually not setting up their risk models and their balance sheet to be able to handle that. In the same way that you know, you're like, I'll do, as a homeowner, yeah, if my cabinet breaks, I'm going to fix it. If this little thing breaks, I'll get an electrician to come. If my sink gets clogged, I'll get a plumber. I'm not going to call my insurers. But when a big thing happens, I am going to file a claim, right?
Yeah.
But actually, the same exact thing happens for the insurers. They say, I'm going to cover all this kind of types of loss. But when a giant wildfire comes through and wipes out 500 of my homes at once, I'm going to file a claim, usually for anything over $100 million of loss. And I'll file a claim to my reinsurer, and I'm going to buy reinsurance for that.
Right.
And so reinsurers insure insurance companies. And what they're really insuring are these giant catastrophes, these large crises that are being exacerbated by climate change.
Sorry, and the reinsurers are broadly based in Bermuda or London.
And Switzerland. Exactly. It's the safety net below the safety net. You got to be real sure it's still there. It's the second parachute. You got to make sure it works.
Right.
So that's the background. And that is where it's based. And what we're doing, though, is we come along, we have said, as we talked a little earlier, it's like, hey, the models here, they're no longer working. There's been a 3x increase in billion-dollar catastrophes. That's resulted in an over 60% loss in return on equity for this industry over the last 10 years.
60% loss.
Yeah. Reduction, rather. Sorry.
Right.
Apologies. Yeah. Not loss. It's been a 60% reduction from where it was a decade ago.
Business is not nearly as good as it used to
exactly.
be.
Exactly. Basically. And you just have to, as we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, you just kind of have to look outside to realize that, right? And the other thing about insurance is like, it is the OG data scientist. In fact, the insurance industry invented data science back in the day. I believe, if I remember right, it was doing actuarial tables in Scotland as a life insurance policy for the wives of preachers. And so they built data science trying to understand life expectancy of the clergy, and then they would pool money together to take care of their widows if they died. And that was the beginning of data science.
Scottish widows.
Exactly. Scottish widows. It was the beginning of data science.
Right.
And yet, we now can drive cars with data science and AI. We can re-land spaceships, right? Like, and yet, we haven't really done an update in this original insurance industry of the actual understanding of risk of these actual models.
So why is that, right? Because if it feels like reinsurance, which is the parachute, you know, the second parachute that underlies this whole gigantic industry, their whole business is risk and being smarter than anybody else in the world at assessing risk. How is it that they're like kind of not keeping up with the times when this is the absolute core of their business?
I'd give a few reasons. One is the classic innovator's dilemma. The industry was making great returns for decades, right? Mm. And then climate change happened. And when you're making great returns, you kind of have a hard time steering the boat, right?
You get complacent.
You get complacent. Yeah. And these are huge ships, huge businesses that have been operating certain ways. It's hard to move them to change the direction, right? Like to change a big tanker.
Right.
You have to plan that out many years in advance. So that's one. Two is what also happens in big industries is this, in our opinion, this horizontalization of incentives. So often this is talked about in the auto industry, you know, everything got outsourced and horizontal and that didn't serve the industry well, same in space. And that's kind of the verticalization of those two industries, which, you know, Tesla is the example of has allowed it to, you know, and SpaceX has allowed it to be much more efficient with cost and align incentives. And that similar sort of thing happened, in our opinion, in reinsurance, where 15, 20 years ago, the numbers are like, hey, we need to increase margins. We want to, you know, improve. Well, what's one of our most costly things? Oh, all the actuarial departments are really costly.
Yeah.
Hey, look, there's this new industry of SaaS providers, of technology providers doing modeling that we can hire and spend less. So let's do that. And so what's happened is the reinsurers have kind of outsourced a lot of this. And the problem, though, is it's a technology provider and their incentive isn't aligned, right? If they provide a model and the reinsurer loses a bunch of money, they still got to pay their SaaS bill and they still got to go back the next year, right? And so our model, we don't sell software. We sell reinsurance and we put some of our skin in the game along with the bigger pots of money out there because we believe that's a better system for the whole ecosystem. Because we're actually aligned with the risk, right? We're saying...
So you're actually a reinsurance company.
Exactly. It's easier in many ways to just sell software, to actually set up the infrastructure and manage all the regulatory component to being a... to reinsure, you have to... It takes more work. But we think it's a better business model and also just aligns these incentives, right? As we go to the big pots of money out there who are putting their money on the line for risk, we say, hey, look, you know, we're putting some of our money on, and it's actually a huge percentage of the total balance sheet we have, although very small compared to what they're putting to work. We're putting some of our skin in the game too.
So how much money have you guys raised?
We have raised just shy of $30 million so far.
$30 million in the insurance, reinsurance world sounds really small.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is. So it's like, great, we can insure two homes in Palo Alto. Fantastic. We're making a difference. No, so we'll get a little into the weeds here and tell me if this gets too much. But
yeah.
The way we first set up, so there's sort of what we're doing right now, and then there's what's in the works. What we first have set up is a what's called a managing general agent, an MGA, and we are a reinsurance MGA. And what that essentially means is that we are a glorified broker who has the pen. And I actually find one of the best analogies of this, and maybe some of you listening will understand how this works too, is the venture capital world, mm-hmm. right? If I go raise money from a VC, I think I'm raising money from, and I am, I mean, name some of our leads, like for us, as a True or a Crew Capital, right? True Ventures or a Crew Capital.
Yeah.
Those are the people I have a relationship with. That's who I say I raise money from, et cetera. But in fact, they have the large percentage of their funds, right, is from LPs.
Is their LPs.
Exactly. Right. We work in the same way, right? When we're selling reinsurance, people are like, oh, you're getting it from Kettle. But the vast majority are from LPs, which we call risk capital providers or capacity providers.
Okay.
And the interesting part is there are actually a lot of the same pots of money that are LPs and venture funds as well. They're big pension funds, they're hedge funds. And then the last bucket is traditional reinsurers. And they put money to work with us saying, okay, well, you know, you guys take your fees, you put the deal together, but we believe that your models, you're going to make a return here. We believe in your models. We believe in the work that you're doing and that you're going to find good investments or good risks to support.
Got you. And so what does your model do? Like, how does it work? Like, what is it doing that these kind of outsourced kind of actuarial models that you talk about, what is the mousetrap that you've built that's different?
Yeah. First, I'll start from a data flow perspective. So we gather data from all this geospatial data, all this weather data, all these different sources. We're constantly out evaluating new private sources of data. Mm-hmm. And we bring all that in and we translate it all into a format and structure that works really well for reinsurance and insurance. The nice part is that a lot of this data, I will say, is it's open data. In my previous role, I used to work in the White House in the Office of Science, Technology, Policy, and I focused on opening up data specifically actually for humanitarian use. I was working with USAID and FEMA. It's actually part of how I got obsessed with insurance. And I have great thanks for everyone who did that, because what we're doing is we are gathering a ton of the data that has been made public by NOAA and by NASA for the last 30 years. And we bring all of that in, we translate it, put in some other data of our own, so we get some other real estate data, et cetera. And then we create two models, and they're both machine learning models, AI models. The first one is focused on the chance of a fire starting. It's called our ignition model. And the second one is how mm-hmm. a fire spreads. It's called our spread model. And essentially what they're trying to do is figure out what's the chance that this lat long, this exact spot on the map, what's the percent chance we think it's going to burn down in the next 12 months? And between those two models, we can put a probability on that. Now, we use a specific form of machine learning called swarm neural networks, or it comes from particle swarm optimization. And it's often been used in robotics or genetics. And what's cool about this is we're actually running many side-by-side neural networks, and they're each being trained on a specific variable. And the reason why this works really well is if you think about fires or mega fires, some of the key things to know is that there are over 10,000 wildfires a year in California. Last year, 14 of them caused 99% of the damage. And that's almost always the case. There are a few of them that get out of hand and cause a huge amount of damage.
Yeah.
We're actually very good at putting out fires. We put out the vast majority of them. The question is, you know, which are going to be the 14 and what were the things that caused them to happen? And so what the AI is looking for are all of the factors that align to cause this sort of terrible outcome.
Right. The factors are like what? Wind?
A lot of fires start along a road, right? Whether that's because of the electricity wires or trash or things that get thrown out of the road, et cetera. Like that. So let's say the AI is looking at a situation like, okay, there's this thing that looks like a road. It's this gray set of pixels that are driving along. And to the right of it is miles of green, right? Of trees, or brown, unfortunately, right now in California.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It hasn't rained for 6 months. And it's that time of year where the winds are blowing really hard off the ocean and they're blowing to the east. So to the east of this road is this unstopped area of trees. The winds are blowing really hard and it's uphill. So a couple of key things are, so fires burn faster uphill. There's no natural fire breaks in the way. The other thing is there's no other roads that come anywhere into this giant forest. So there's no access to get fire trucks there. We know that everything is really dry because of the weather and the vegetation index is low, et cetera, or the moisture vegetation index is low. And so these different factors have all come together, and the winds are a major factor come in. And we know the chance of ignition is high because it's right next to this road. And
right
now suddenly you've got a whole bunch of variables all aligned in the wrong direction. And you say, this is a pretty high chance that this is going to go.
Right.
Now you could have the same situation, but there's a big old Walmart right there, right? With a huge parking lot. And suddenly you're like, well, there's a good chance a fire could start here because you're still next to the road and you still have this set of trees, but then it's going to blow right into this parking lot and then someone's going to put it out right away, right?
The asphalt fire.
Exactly. So that's a little bit of a zoom in, but that's what it's doing. Now, compared to the normal, most best in class kind of modeling in the past has been to run 100,000 simulations, roughly. Mm-hmm. And usually it's kind of done, you know, stochastically, as I mentioned earlier.
And those 100,000 simulations, just bring it back down to the level of, like, you know, on the individual level, that will spit out at the end of it a premium.
Right, exactly.
To insure this building, it will cost you whatever, 50% more than maybe something a mile from here, because these are all our risk factors and this is what we think it costs to for us to, like, you know, kind of take on the risk.
Exactly. And it's predominantly looking at the historical data, being like, this area has burned X amount of times in the last 500 years. It's a 1 in 250. We're going to run a bunch of different simulations. And across those 100,000 simulations, this area burns down twice in every 500 years or something, et cetera. And then the outcome is exactly that, a premium. And I'll get more into how premiums are done at the reinsurance level. But essentially, yeah, what is the risk of this and what do we need to charge for it for a wildfire cover?
Right.
In our models, we're running 42 billion simulations for every turn of our model, which we run, you know, every 2 weeks. So it's just a total brute force order of magnitude different level. And that's the power of machine learning, right? That's the technology we now have in our hands.
And that brute force difference yields presumably something that's more accurate or more complete. I mean, I'm just trying to understand, you know, so if the old way of doing it is like, here's our 500 years of data, we're going to do a bunch of different simulations, and this is the number it spits out, you're doing 42 billion. The theory is that your accuracy can be a bit more pinpoint and a bit more fine-tuned than these old models.
Correct. Yeah. So you know that, okay, only maybe 0.1% of the homes are going to burn down this year, but we have a better idea of where that's going to happen.
Right.
And if you know that, then you can charge the appropriate premium for those areas, which is high, which also, to get back to climate, should incentivize people to not live and build homes in places that have a really high chance of burning down.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the people who are in not highest areas don't see their rates go through the roof or have them start having policies drop in areas where it's really not as high as we think. And what's happened, right, is there's this feeling of the whole state's going to burn down. And we don't know exactly where it is. We know some, you know, we have rough ideas, but we don't really know. And so we're just going to raise the rates on this entire zip code.
Everywhere.
Right? Or really on everywhere. And then, yeah, and then specifically like on this area or this zip code. And for us, we're like, well, actually, this part over here is pretty safe. And this part just over here, you're right, it is 50% more dangerous and it should be charged accordingly.
Got you. Where are you from?
I grew up outside Philadelphia.
Outside Philly. So.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You grew up the son of artists.
That's right.
Who said, whatever you do, don't get into insurance.
Oh, sorry, Mom.
So what was the circuitous path, presumably, to getting to actually going against your parents' wishes and getting into insurance?
So to get real here, actually, I was in college doing that thing where you just study everything that looks interesting to you in the course book. I ended up studying philosophy and Eastern philosophy, and I ended up studying abroad by living in a monastery for 3 months in Japan. So I spent a lot of time meditating.
So you studied Eastern philosophy and you went and did a study abroad. And I studied abroad in Costa Rica, San Jose, Costa Rica.
Cool.
And spent every weekend drinking cheap beer and and running around and just being generally an idiot. You went and spent 3 months in a monastery.
I did. Yeah, I did. And it was enlightening. I did go to some fun noise rock concerts in Osaka. You know, I had to have a few moments to break out. That was a good time. But I did spend most of that 3 months on a cushion. And I also happened, you know, this might be, I don't know, trite, but like, it's true. I had watched Inconvenient Truth kind of right before going. And I think I'd taken a class that was, again, I was in philosophy. It's called Religion Gone Wild, you know, philosophy, humans, and natural environment. And those two things happened. And what happened was I came out of that being like, climate change is a problem. And it's a big problem. And this is something that I want to really dedicate my life to.
So you saw Inconvenient Truth, then you went and meditated for 3 months. And then you're like, this is it. I've got it. Clarity. Right.
It's important to have some purpose, right? You know,
absolutely.
Victor Frankl. Came out of it feeling some purpose and went back to school, ended up doing a master's in environmental science, focusing on the clean development mechanism on what was the Kyoto Protocol and essentially carbon finance.
Yeah.
For folks who don't know, we had a global carbon finance system to put a price on carbon, and the US wouldn't sign the treaty, and therefore China wouldn't sign the treaty. And therefore, it never really took off. So it could have been a very different world, frankly, if Florida went differently in 2000. But not to go too far down that line, that path, that counterfactual. It's a hard one to feel. That's why I studied, came out. I ended up working in clean tech. You know, I had definitely had the belief and still do of, hey, if we could just make clean technology cheaper and more profitable than dirty technology, we can solve this, a lot of this problem. I do think that having policies and carbon finance and things like that in place to do that is a good move, but we didn't. But I focused on a whole bunch of different mitigation technologies. I was working kind of consulting, doing this throughout South Asia and Southeast Asia for a number of years. But I always had this kind of entrepreneurial desire, this pull to good old Bay Area. And so I moved here, went to one of these programs about how technology is going to solve all the big problems in the world. And ended up meeting this organization called Ushahidi, which means witness or testimony. And at the time, built the largest open source software platform for crisis response in the world. And I was just really taken with the organization. I was empowered by open source software. I thought this is really cool. And it also had been working globally. Ushahidi means witness or testimony in Swahili, by the way. And the organization was founded out of Kenya. So I was doing that. And I also, at that point too, had this kind of sad feeling of like, man, we kind of failed on the mitigation part. Like I started seeing the writing on the walls and was like, we're going to need to help people. So I was doing that. I ended up, as I mentioned earlier, going to, from there, working in the White House as part of the first class of Presidential Innovation Fellows, which is now, you know, there's some amazing programs and any technologist should go check these out around bringing your technology skills into the US Gov. And this is back in 2012, 2013, got to be kind of on the front line of that. And I was there when Sandy hit the East Coast. And so I like slept on the floor of FEMA for 3 or 4 nights working on it. I was working on opening up data for humanitarian use. And between that and working at Ushahidi, which I went back to after a year and a half in DC, I ended up running that organization in Ushahidi, what I just saw was two things. One, these crises is increasing, right? And I was watching it firsthand.
Yeah.
Two, that insurance companies and were the ones who were fascinated with this data, which makes sense, right?
Yeah.
And that's what got me into insurance. I was like, this is kind of cool. And then I had this realization that if you think about it like a graph where you graph sort of these big catastrophes and you think suffering on the y-axis and time over the x-axis, you see this big spike in suffering at the beginning, right? You have sort of 2 weeks of really triaging hospitals. The news is there.
Like what's happening right now in like Louisiana with Hurricane Ida.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Or in Caldor, like the front page of the New York Times today, it's Ida, it's Tahoe. But in 2 weeks, it won't be as much, right?
Right.
Or at least not in Ida's case. And donations will slow down.
Yep.
And you will have solved the kind of a lot of the life-saving moments, right? And everyone kind of moves on. But what then you have this long tail of rebuilding everything. Mm-hmm. And really that is just like their communities. It's just communities, FEMA, and their insurance companies. And it's really communities and their insurance companies for this long tail. And I had this feeling that like if you graft this, the area under the long tail might be just as big, if not bigger, than the area under the kind of spike at the beginning. And so the total suffering from crises, like if you could improve the insurance industry, you could really reduce suffering. And I still believe that very much.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting you say that. I think I mentioned when we spoke before, I did a piece on the wildfires last year and went up and spoke to a bunch of people and was at one of these kind of, I can't remember what they call them. They're like reaction centers or kind of help centers.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to a guy and he had lost his trailer in the Paradise fire.
Mm-hmm.
And he, since then, which had been 2 years prior, he'd been like being bounced around to different FEMA funded kind of refugee camps, basically, mm-hmm. in California.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about that long tail of suffering, there's a whole swathe of people like him who had their homes burned down to the ground. Some of them had insurance, some of them did not. But a lot of them who did, they're still fighting with their insurance companies or there's some issue. And they're just living this kind of horrendous existence where they don't have a home and they have no certainty and there's nowhere they can kind of go when they're just like, you know, as you say, you have that quick spike where everything burns to the ground and then it's 2 years later still trying to figure out what you're doing with your life, basically.
No, it's completely traumatic and it's awful.
And so what you're doing now, how does that long tail of suffering, how does that help? Because it really feels like what this is about is having people who are insured, like get the money and get them to start rebuilding their life or whatever it may be, kind of like expedite that process.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so what we're doing now is trying to build, I mean, ultimately the job of reinsurance in this case is to be the ones writing the checks to that person to rebuild their life. So what we're trying to do is put one more money into these safety nets than there was before because the risk has increased. And to say, hey, we need to be able to make these people whole. Two is the system isn't very efficient at the moment to kind of what we talked about earlier. If you can improve the efficiency of the whole thing, you can improve the outcome for that person at the end, which is what's really important, both from a speed perspective, also just from like a, I don't have the exact numbers, but like the amount of each dollar that ends up in that person's hand at the end of the day is not as high a percentage as it should be. And we could make it much better.
Yeah.
And part of that is like, if you have better modeling and if you use technology to like, to do a lot of these systems a lot better, there's a lot we're working on, parametric structures, things like this, aligning the incentives is a major part. I mean, what you're doing with insurance, I talked about earlier, that is quite beautiful is when you're paying your premiums, you are essentially saying, hey, I'll put a little money in to help that guy who had his trailer burned down, get his life whole. Right.
Right.
But what I'm going to do is give it to you, this intermediary, to manage and most efficiently distribute it and understand the best way to do it, right? And what needs to happen is those intermediaries need to, if they can use technology to be more effective at understanding the risk and more just effective at like the transfer and movement of money and risk and overhead and all this stuff, then you can make sure that more, the higher percentage of that dollar that you're paying on your premium is ending up in that person who needs it hand.
So you're seeing all this in your previous life running Ushahidi, and then at a certain point, you take the plunge?
Oh, like any hard thing. I was actually working on it for years, trying to figure out the right way to, like any early startup, right? These testing a bunch of products. Oh man, some of them were so wrong. You know, and just talking to as many people as I could, many false starts. But eventually, and I think in many cases, this might be the true story for many people, you know, it was my partner, it was my wife who was like, Matt, you got to just do this. Like, come on, stop talking. Because gave me the courage. I put in my notice with a good 6 months to sort of help train the next leadership of Ushahidi. And Angela, by the way, who's doing, shout out to her, is doing an incredible job. And so we worked on that. We worked on that transition. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to just go make this happen. And in that process, actually, I had a friend who's a designer. He runs an incredible design firm called Occupop. And he's got blonde hair down to here. And he lives in Hawaii. And he looks like kind of like the coolest guy you've ever met. And I was talking his ear off about insurance, very much like this conversation here. And he laughs. And at the end of it is like, nah, man, do I look like someone that wants to spend an hour talking about insurance? But I'll tell you what, that was fascinating. And the only other person I've ever met who's made insurance sound half as interesting as you is this guy, Andrew, you guys should meet. And so he introduced me to Andrew. And Andrew was really, you know, the missing puzzle piece for me at that moment, you know, and I had not come from insurance. I was trying to start something in this space, but Andrew had spent his whole life in insurance. At the time, he was the VP of machine learning and digital at Argo Group, which is a public specialty and insurer and reinsurer. And we just hit it off. We had so much fun, as Michael knew we would. And we kept talking. And then there was a point where I was like, you know, hey, Andrew, you want to quit your fancy job, having a great time and being on the beach in Bermuda and try to do a startup instead? And, you know, good on him. He agreed. So we kicked it off, and this was kind of summer of 2019. And like anything, you know, got to work, had a bunch of bad ideas, recruited some people, still tried to kind of, like, he also had to put in his notice and do all of that. But we got the wheels turning, tested out a bunch of different ideas. You know, even was kind of the classic kind of walk around a Target asking people if they wanted to buy evacuation insurance, like any good user research should be done. There's a lot of stories there. I could get into some hilarious ones, but that's how we kicked it off.
And you tried to get into YC, Y Combinator.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
I ask because this week I was just watching Demo Day, 370 companies from 50 countries doing their 1 minute pitches back to back to back to back to back to back to back. It's quite a machine.
Yeah, totally. It is a machine. And so, yeah, this one goes out both of the thanks to YFC and for everyone that didn't get in. So what happened is, yeah, Andrew and I had met. We've been talking. He was really acting as kind of an advisor at the beginning. We actually, to get really fun, we had two ideas that we were testing. One, we'd gone out and I'd done a survey of everyone. It's like, hey, what's a big thing you had to spend money on that you weren't expecting to? And one of them, actually the number one answer to that survey I did was, I'm curious, can you guess?
No idea.
It's totally in left field from what we've been talking about. It was fertility. It was IVF.
Whoa.
But that's also like I was interviewing mostly, you know, people in the Bay Area in New York who are, in their 30s and, you know, exactly. So it's a specific group, but they're also people who have the money to spend on a kind of a new insurance product. And then the second one we had developed was around evacuations. So we were testing both, but we definitely had that moment where we looked back and we're like, we're two dads. This is not the right product, you know, founder fit.
Yeah.
It is something that should exist. Some people do have it, and I'll just leave it there. And I hope someone does build a direct to consumer version of that product at one day. But we were like, this is not the right thing for us, even if that's what the user group said.
Yeah.
So we then were working more on evacuation insurance, which again aligned actually to the kind of climate change background and the work there and what we were, you know, I was really still felt that purpose and passion about. And the idea there was like, hey, when this is what we pitch YC, you know, we'll put $3,000 in your pocket in less than an hour if you're in a mandatory evacuation zone. So it's a parametric product. You paid like 10 to 30 bucks a month, depending on where you lived, if you're in risky or high risk. And if you were in a mandatory evacuation, that triggered the system and it just put that money in your bank account right away. Cool stuff. The problem that you know, we pitched it. We got an interview in YC, which allowed us to really start working. We brought in Son, our third co-founder, who was the one of the head quants. He'd worked at Andrew for years and head engineer at Argo. And we started working on this. We built the whole prototype. It was really cool. Went into YC, pitched it, and they did narrow down very quickly, to their credit, on the one problem, which is like, well, if you sell this direct to consumer, the only people who will buy it are the ones who are in the highest risk of evacuation. It's called, and which is a classic insurance problem. And there are ways to get around that, which is like, if you were selling it through employers and it was, you know, just went to everyone who had a Gusto account or something, or try, you know, et cetera, like that could work. Right. But if you are just selling, you know, direct to consumer, even though there was interest, you're really just going to get a bunch of people in Napa, Sonoma, and Miami, and Louisiana, and that's not going to balance out enough. And so, you know, we didn't get in. We're like, oh, bummer. And we kind of sat back, like, we still want to do this. And we took the part that was focused on fire. I was like, well, could we build this out and essentially build out what we have today, which is, can we change this and focus on the actual understanding of the risk and leverage our understanding of reinsurance, which is, you know, if insurance has started getting insurtech upgrades over the last 5 to 10 years, you know, our opinion was like, well, reinsurance will be next. You know, most people don't know what this is, and it'll move down the chain. So that was our thesis. And we moved into that and we said, okay, we're going to lick our wounds. We didn't get into YC, but that's okay. And we'll just keep working on it. So we then spent the next 6 months, you know, just working on the prototypes and getting everything set up and building out the team a bit more. And yeah, and then went to market and raised that first round. And it's been a roller coaster of excitement ever since.
How was actually raising money? Was it, because again, you know, insurtech, it's not the sexiest, it's a big market, but you know, I'm just wondering how, like, what the reception was amongst, you know, Silicon Valley types and Sand Hill Road and all those type of, you know, folks when you're going around trying to get meetings. Were you able to even get meetings?
Look, we were very blessed, is the best way to put it. We were able to, one, I think I've been lucky enough to just to know some great people, a couple. So actually, to those startup folks out here, this is what I would say is, I know some amazing other entrepreneurs, and they're your best resource. So some incredible other, you know, entrepreneurs who have been mentors to me and friends who spent years just like grabbing coffee, listening to every bad version of my pitches for years as I tried to make something happen in insurance or that area, thanks to you guys. And they made a bunch of interest for me, and that caused a snowball to happen. And honestly, we had incredible reception, and we ended up having actually 14 written term sheets, which was insane. So, and you know, it's also so important, the why now that everyone talks about. Like, you know, we incorporated the company officially in February 2020. Like, does anyone remember what was happening right around February 2020? You know, and then I'd quit my job 6 months before, Andrew now and everyone quit. And then like, boom, COVID. And I'm panicked. Oh my God, we're never going to have it. We're never going to be able to raise. Did you see the Sequoia letter that went out? Like, this is Black Swan. And Andrew goes, to his credit, because he's been in, you know, insurance for reinsurance for 15 years or more, goes, nah, this is the best thing that could happen. Because what's going to happen is everyone's going to freeze. They're going to freeze all their funds. They're going to pull their money out, and rates are going to spike. And we can come in and bring stability back to the market after this price dislocation. And that's exactly what we've been trying to do. So took a deep breath, waited out that summer, went to go raise that first round, and feel very blessed for how that all went. Love our investors. They're incredible. And honestly, they came around, you know, 6 months later, and we're like, guys, you're just on a tear. We're gonna double down. Let's preempt your A round. And so it was actually our existing investors that just then led the next round. So big shout out, loved all of them. Homebrew, Accrue, Anthemis, and True.
Right. And the kind of the upshot of what you guys are doing is that, say, you know, going back to explaining how the kind of the models work, is that, you know, if you're in a high fire zone, I know here and in places in, like, you know, Florida that are, you know, in flood or hurricane zones, insurance companies have been trying to pull out altogether. And then you have regulators trying to force them to stay. And also saying, and by the way, you can only raise premiums by X amount. because of what otherwise it's unaffordable. So there's a real tension point there. So is the breach then for you to step in and be like, all right, we can reinsure this risk that is still quite expensive, but not nearly as expensive as this kind of like blanket jacking up of prices that others are trying to force upon you?
That's right. And so I know for most people, it's hard to have empathy for the big old insurance companies out there, but they are, and I'll just speak to kind of to California and wildfire at the moment, they are getting really squeezed, because what's happened is they're regulated, so they're only allowed to increase their rates, you know, a certain amount per year for admitted policies, which the vast majority of home ownership is. And then what addition happened the last 2 years, the Sacramento Governor Newsom has put a moratorium on being able to drop policies in certain areas. I think this year it was 800,000 homes out of 14 right. million, or it's actually it's about 12.5 million homes, I think, 14 million structures, were in areas that couldn't be dropped. So insurers couldn't drop them. And you got to imagine those are pretty high risk areas to be put under that. So now insurers, they can't drop homes, they can't really raise rates, but the risks have increased. And then what happened in the reinsurance world is, which isn't regulated by the state in the same way, they have, as I mentioned at the beginning, because of COVID, because of the fact that the models aren't working anymore, like, you know, reinsurers lost $20 billion, I think it's 2016 or 2017, the first big year, and then apologies, and then they lost in almost the same amount again in the next year, and that was the last like 25 years of premiums all together, like wiped out, and then again. And so what happened was, when all this is everyone said, "Oh man, the models aren't working anymore. I'm out." And so the supply dries up, but that demand is still there. You know,
the reinsurance supply dries up.
The reinsurance supply right. dries up for wildfire specifically.
Yeah, yeah.
But the demand, primary insurers are regulated. They're required to buy a certain amount of reinsurance and they can't drop. So now the price of reinsurance goes like 15 to 30x compared to wow. what it was pre-2016. And the insurers in the middle just have to do it because they're not even allowed to drop certain areas or... Yeah. You know, and also they don't want to drop their customers. Like, what company in the world, particularly public companies that are required to grow, want to go around like cutting their customers out, right? That's their like that is their revenue. So now they're essentially just stuck. And what we can do is come along and say, hey, we have a better understanding of this risk. It is riskier than it used to be. It's riskier than it was pre-2016. Yeah. We were undercharging, you know, at that point. But it's not 30x riskier, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're talking it's 3x, 4x riskier from a, right. a loss perspective. And so let's bring some balance back to that. But because the supply's gone and the demand's there, the existing, you know, market's basically like, and folks don't really understand the risk. They're just like, you know what? The model says this, I'm just going to double it because maybe it's wrong. And maybe I'll just even triple it because they'll pay it and I don't want to get caught. And so I'm just going to charge as much as I can. So this is how it works. If you remember kind of like post 2008, like, a lot of the banks stop loaning,
yep.
rates go up, people can't get mortgages, people can't get loans. And then newer folks came in and said, you know what, like giving student loans to people that went to MIT is pretty safe. I think we should keep doing this, et cetera.
Right. And then so just lastly, just stepping back, I mean, you guys are starting with wildfire, but I mean, we talked earlier about Hurricane Ida. There was like, you know, massive flooding in Germany this summer. There were wildfires in Athens. I mean, all of this is the idea that you're starting here and then you will broaden out and start to kind of build models for hurricanes, for flooding, for freezes like happened in Texas, things like that, to build kind of like a whole suite of, you know, insurance for all the calamities that await us.
The way we think about that, I think, might be helpful for folks understand is you think about it in a kind of classic 2x2 again, you know, in a graph, and on one axis essentially will machine learning give you a real competitive advantage, right? How stochastic is this risk? So in an earthquake example, earthquakes are actually pretty stochastic. Like there are some cool companies doing some stuff around machine learning to understand the risks of the damage that earthquakes will cause, but actually predicting an earthquake is hard. It's not like machine learning models necessarily going to make that much bigger of a difference.
Hold on one sec. Can you define stochastic?
Yeah, random. Random.
Okay.
And sort of it's a statistical term for like trying to predict randomness.
Random events, right? Got you.
Yeah, and on the other end, you have wildfires, right? Which I mentioned earlier. You have 10,000 of them a year, and 14 of them cause really big events. Right. And there are certain factors that you can turn, and so you can run machine learning models on all 10,000 of those fires every year and figure out. And that's a lot of data that you can now put through a system that it can learn off of, right?
Yeah.
Why did those ones go out and these ones didn't? And this one got big and this one didn't, et cetera. Why did the spread stop here? So, and you have 30 years of satellite imagery to be able to do that off of, and which is amazing. Again, thank you to NOAA and NASA for doing this. And so, and on the other hand is what's called price dislocation, or on the other axis. And that is, we could go and say, hey, look, we think we have a better model for understanding flood and hurricane right now than anyone else. The machine learning model is doing a better job. And it says that you're underpricing. You're charging $2 million for $100 million of cover. But really, the risk these days should for Louisiana or this area, it should be more like four or five, or whatever, yeah. Right? However, in the market, you know, if you go and try to sell that to Allfarm, they're going to be, it's called greater fool theory. They're going to be like, why would I pay you four? I don't care that it's a better model. I'm paying them too. They gave me a cheaper price. Exactly. They're the one who are on the hook.
Exactly.
You have to wait for this price dislocation to happen, like what's happened in California.
I see.
Where you can then come in with a better model and reset the price and bring stability back to the market.
You have to be able to come in and be like, for you, my friend, special price. I give you basically you have to wait for the proverbial to really hit the fan.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, as a new entrant in the market, right? You gotta be able to do that. So we look for those two things, and then that's how we think about where we'll move next.
Fascinating. It's a miracle. We spoke for an hour about insurance.
best part of my day.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Nat for taking the time. I want to thank you all for listening, for giving the ratings and reviews and telling your friends, your neighbors, your loved ones, your enemies, your friends, everybody about Danny in the Valley and what a wonderful thing it is and how it's changed your life for the better or something like that. I will be in the paper this week. I'm probably writing about Facebook. It's been a really bad week for Facebook. Some really damning revelations. So doing a big number on that. So do check that out. You can find me on Twitter at Danny Fortson. Email me danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk. That is it for this week. Have a fabulous weekend. Take care, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye. Want more out of this podcast? Go to thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley to read articles based on these interviews, broader discussions of the topics covered here, and of course, the amazing work of all my colleagues across the rest of the paper, all for less than £1 a day. Start your free trial now by going to thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.